'Twas a long time ago, longer now than it seems, in a place that perhaps you've seen in your dreams. For the story that you are about to be told took place in the holiday worlds of old. Now, you've probably wondered where holidays come from. If you haven't, I'd say it's time you begun.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus movie review of A Nightmare Before Christmas.
How horrible our Christmas will be.
No! How jolly!
Oh, how jolly our Christmas will be.
Hosted by Jacob.
That's not Sandy Claus.
It isn't?
Jerry.
My God! I'm really going to give it all my might!
And Arnie.
Three of a kind.
Birds of a feather, now and forever.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
It's suspicious.
It's peculiar.
It's scary.
Listener discretion is advised.
Eureka! This year, Christmas will be ours!
What's this? What's this? Tonight we're discussing Tim Burton's A Nightmare Before Christmas, featuring the voices of Chris Sarandon, Danny Elfman, Catherine O'Hara, William Hickey, directed by Henry Selick. I'm the Podcast King, Arnie.
And this is Jerry.
And this is the reason for the season, Jacob.
Well, the real reason that I am merry this holiday season is because of our patrons. Guys, it has been an incredible year thanks to you guys, the ones who are donating monthly to help this show grow and keep on going and get these bonus shows. I just want to say right now during the season, I think I speak for all of us on and off the mic. Thank you so much for your support. And as your final thank you Christmas gift, here's A Nightmare Before Christmas.
Though, the one thing I do want to try to settle, is this a Christmas movie or is it a Halloween movie? This is like Die Hard all over again.
Why can't it be both?
It came out originally at Halloween, but having watched it, I think it's got to be a Christmas movie. I mean, it starts when Halloween ends and ends on Christmas. It kind of follows a Grinchy pattern. I think it's a Christmas movie.
And I think you're right, and Grinch is right as well. They said one of the big influences for this was that old, not that Jim Carrey Grinch or that new CGI one that's out, but that old Chuck Jones animated one or the Rankin-Bass Rudolph TV specials. That's the kind of vibe they're really going for with this film.
You're the fan. Did you see this when it first came out?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if it was weekend of release, but I definitely saw this in theater. Here's the thing. Living in L.A., when it comes to movies and all that, it's just a little bit different than everywhere else. And I remember before this movie came out, there's a radio station. It used to be an awesome alternative radio station called K-Rock. They would break all kinds of new bands. Love Line with Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew. Like, that's where all that came from. They've really gone downhill. But back in the day when they were a great alternative station, like, they would play this soundtrack before the movie came out. They're like, oh guys, this soundtrack is awesome. And they play, like, I'd be getting ready for school in the morning and What's This is playing on the radio.
Yeah, the fact that this is Danny Elfman singing and performing, Oingo Boingo was a big new wave band, K-Rock was really into that alternative and new wave scene. I could see why they'd latch onto this, although I don't really think this has an alternative music flair in any of the songs. Jerry, what about you?
Well, I am undoubtedly the newbie on this podcast. And funny enough, when the movie first came out on VHS, a bunch of us were having a little gathering. This was when we were in college. We just all got together at somebody's house to play cards. And someone popped the movie in. And I sat down on the couch. I was like, oh, hey, I kind of wanted to see this. And after about 6 or 7 minutes, I was like, hey, deal me in. I just want to play cards. I don't get this movie. Here's the funny thing. My second viewing attempt was this past Friday.
First complete viewing.
No. No, just wait. I fell asleep during it.
This is like 72 minutes long. How could you fall asleep?
Well, let me explain. It wasn't the film's fault. I popped it in at like 11 o'clock. I'd done a lot of stuff during the day. I mean, it was one of those, like, I'm just going to sit here and fall asleep. But the next night, I watched it in its entirety. And then earlier today, I watched it in its entirety. So I am 2 for 4 on lifetime attempts of watching this movie. And hey, batting 500 is not bad, folks.
Well, you've only seen it twice. I've only seen it twice. I remember this movie coming out, and it said in big letters, Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, and I thought it was a Tim Burton film. I mean, why wouldn't you? I thought Tim Burton directed it.
Yeah, I thought this was a Tim Burton film for years, till I think, like, IMDb came out and blew my mind.
And I was a fan of Tim Burton from Beetlejuice and Batman, but this movie came out in fall of 93. I was a sophomore in college. I had no car. I had no money. So I didn't go to the theaters very much. I had to look because I knew I went to the theater some. Once in a while, I'd go back home to visit my parents and use that as an opportunity to take their car to the theaters. I saw Demolition Man 2 weeks before this came out. I saw The Three Musketeers about a month after this came out.
Ooh.
Hey, Three Musketeers is the one that kicked this movie out of the number one spot at the box office.
I'm a big fan, by the way, so I get it.
It's a guilty pleasure. But I never saw this. I wanted to. It looked like Beetlejuice with the stop motion animation. But time passed and I never saw it. Then the strange thing happened. It went away for a while and came back with a massive vengeance, where now I was seeing ornaments at Target and I was going to the Disney store and inundated by Jack Skellington, and it started making me feel like I have really missed out on a major piece of pop culture of my generation. So I think it was about 3 years ago, Marjorie and I sat down and finally popped our Nightmare Before Christmas cherry, and then I watched it a second time for this review.
Wow, okay, so you're pretty new too. Jerry just saw it for the first time, and you saw it just a few years ago. Yeah, this was kind of a sleeper hit, but it has become a huge thing. You talk about Christmas ornaments at Target, Disneyland, and I guess Disney World and the different Disney resorts. Between Halloween and Christmas, they take the Haunted Mansion and they do it up Nightmare Before Christmas styles. This was a movie that was put out under the Touchstone label because Disney's like, it might be a little too scary for that Disney label, and now Disney's totally embraced it. When I popped in my Blu-ray, it had that Disney castle and the fireworks all over it.
This is killing me because when we reviewed Beetlejuice, we talked about Tim Burton's career. The thing that I love is he started at Disney and he was an animator.
During the bad times, the 80s, Fox and the Hound, The Black Cauldron. I haven't gone back and watched those, but those are movies I remember seeing as a kid and liking them, but I guess those were the bad years for Disney.
Yes, we went into that in detail on our Wreck-It Ralph review. But he was fired from Disney because he made Frankenweenie, and Disney was just like, yeah, you're not for us. This is too dark and scary for children to see. We don't want you here. He'd done Vincent before that, and people liked Vincent, but Frankenweenie, and he was kicked out. And now, A Nightmare Before Christmas is taking over Haunted Mansion.
Yeah.
Who's getting the last laugh?
Well, and I don't know who even saw the original Frankenweenie, talking about the 30-minute live-action short. It would be turned into a stop-motion pictures decades later. And Vincent was just, yeah, he got Vincent Price to do some voiceover over a 5-minute short. The reason I heard on the commentary is they let him go because his art style just didn't match the Disney style. And all the 3D puppets we're going to see here, they showed concept art that Tim Burton did, and yeah, he's got a style that is unconventional when it comes to Disney. You know, you think about Tim Burton, it's kind of goth, kind of creepy, and there you go. Didn't fit into that Disney mold, but this is based off of a poem that he wrote back when he was working with Disney, but he didn't really work on the film that much. He talked about Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, and I thought he was the director for a decade or so, but that was just marketing. They're like, well, he's big, and you know, he did that Batman movie, and he can't direct this one because he's working on Batman Returns. Remember, this took 3 years to make. So they're like, we'll put his name on it, though, because that will get people there. It worked for me. I'm like, oh, Tim Burton's doing this. I want to see it.
It worked for me, too. But where I really laugh is when this came out, it was not on the Disney label because Disney still thought Tim Burton was just too dark and this movie would probably bomb. And so they put it out under their Touchstone label, which was more adult films. And by that, I mean like Three Men and a Baby, not very adult.
Yeah, Adventures in Babysitting. I remember that being a Touchstone picture.
Yeah. Can't Buy Me Love was another one. So.
Okay, yes, there you go. Favorites from my tween years.
And that's why I assume somewhere along the way, Disney acquired this movie. And, you know, back in 93, I didn't get the whole Touchstone Disney connection. I mean, I was freshman in college and just starting to piece things together like this. So yeah, very interesting, because you guys will find this funny. You're probably aware of this, but I'm a member of that Disney movie club. And you know how they send you an email and they'll say, your movie for this month is coming, and they're going to send it to you unless you go out of your way to tell them not to, right?
Oh, so this is like Columbia House.
Like when you used to send the penny in for the 8 CDs.
Exactly. It's not very different, only except that the fact I order so many Marvel and Disney movies and sometimes they have an exclusive version kind of makes it worth it. But anyway, I totally fell asleep on my September-October one. This came to me in a two-pack with Hocus Pocus. So these are Disney. I haven't seen that either.
I've never seen Hocus Pocus.
Yeah, I'd be the newbie on that one, too.
We'll all be the newbie.
But anyway, well, it was the exclusive. The only thing exclusive about it is that these two were in like a box set as like Halloween. So I guess Disney considers a Halloween movie because they sent it out for October and put it in with Hocus Pocus. But what's funny is it's a sing-along edition. I was like, oh, yeah, this is so Disney.
Yeah, I ended up getting the sing-along edition as well. But what I found amusing is Disney did adopt this once it was successful. In 2006, they re-released this into theaters, they converted it to 3D, and that's when they put the Disney label on it and removed the Touchstone label.
Yeah, and they released a lot of the songs done by major bands that I'm sure the young kids have heard of. They are pretty foreign, the names I was reading, but a lot of modern rock bands redid the score, not for the movie, but just for CDs put out with it, or probably bonus.
For Radio Disney.
Which one of these don't you know, Jacob? I really want to know. Marilyn Manson? Fiona Apple?
I didn't know Marilyn Manson did one.
Fallout Boy, Panic at the Disco. These are all pretty big bands.
I kind of know the names. Marilyn Manson, Fiona Apple, Fallout Boy. They did that awful Ghostbusters song. That's all I know about them. Panic at the Disco. I've heard the name. Don't know any of their music.
The only band I don't know that did Kidnap the Sandy Claws was She Wants Revenge.
Nope, don't know who they are either.
But I find it weird when movies in my lifetime become staples. Like A Christmas Story. Do you guys remember when A Christmas Story came out?
Yeah, I remember seeing that on the shelf at the video rental place all the time. I'm like, oh, that kind of looks funny. And then it just became a thing on TV that they play for 24 hours now.
Yeah, I remember seeing it in theaters, walking out of there, my sister saying, that's the dumbest movie I ever saw, and I championed that film for years, and nobody had heard of it, and then suddenly it hit its 10th anniversary, and now that was a craze, and this movie and Groundhog's Day, it's just weird to me, because when I think of Christmas movies, I think Scrooge, It's a Wonderful Life, Miracle on 34th Street, you know, all the classics before I was born, and now here's Nightmare Before Christmas.
Well, and Jacob's right on that one. When TBS or TNT start doing that 24-hour marathon of it, that's when I started taking notes. I was like, why is this a thing? And I had really the same reactions. First time I sat down and watched that, I was like, all right, I want to go do something else.
You just don't like Christmas movies, it sounds like.
Well, I think I'm like Arnie. It's like, yeah, I guess these more modern ones just don't fit into the nostalgia enough for me. I mean, but at the same time, I'm also the guy, if you ask me what my favorite Christmas movie is, I'll tell you Rocky IV.
I'll say Die Hard, but I don't not like Christmas movies. I love Elf, and Elf is one that's kind of become a modern classic too, but I couldn't stand Jim Carrey's Grinch.
Ugh. Now, before we get into the movie, do you guys know what the difference between opera and a musical is? And what would you consider this one? We've done what, one musical before, Xanadu?
Yeah, I know there's a couple of movies like Kiss Meets the Phantom that Stewart considers musicals. To me, it's only a musical if the characters break out in song and nobody looks at them sideways, like Grease. That is a musical to me. And the difference between a musical and opera, operas are usually in Italian.
Well, yeah, of course. And I thought the one thing was with an opera was you can't have talking. And I guess that's wrong. There are operas with talking because Nightmare Before Christmas does feel different than just a musical. To me, a musical, you have a lot of plot and then you have a song that kind of conveys the emotions people are going through. This, if you cut out all the talking parts, I think you could still follow the story with just the songs. Like, I feel like the main motion to push this is those songs. And so that, I guess, would make this more of an opera to me. And the reason that came about with this film, why the songs really push the story, is because Burton and Elfman worked on the song songs before they ever had a script for this. Now, Burton, he had his little poem, but they were working on a script. Burton didn't work on the script at all. He's busy with Batman Returns. But he would meet with Elfman and go, okay, this is how I picture it starting. And okay, I'll write this song. And then he would write, this is Halloween. He's like, okay, what's the next part of the movie? And so like they had all the songs done before they ever had a script for this film.
Well, I heard Elfman say this was the hardest job he's ever had. I mean, he did Oingo Boingo, and then because of Burton, he got into movie scoring, and he'd done a lot by this point. But think about this movie. I know it says Tim Burton's A Nightmare Before Christmas, and it says Henry Selick directed, his directorial debut of the guy who would go on to do Monkey Bone.
Oh, also James and the Giant Peach and Coraline.
Two more stop-motion films that I want to see and have never seen.
You want to see Monkey Bone?
No, I've seen Monkey Bone. I just wanted to see Coraline and James and the Giant Peach and never have.
Okay.
But I think this should really be called Danny Elfman's A Nightmare Before Christmas. He wrote the songs. He sang most of the songs. He did all the music. He did the lyrics, which tell the story. I don't know. I guess because he can't do stop motion animation, this isn't his.
Yeah, you're not wrong, Arnie, because I think he talks the most on the commentary. It's one of those commentaries. They had Tim Burton, they had Henry Selick, and they had Danny Elfman, but they're not in the room together. They're all just recording it, and then someone edited their best parts. And it's mostly Elfman talking, and because he was writing these songs before they ever had a script, he's like, okay, Jack Skellington, what is his struggle? Well, I know when I was in a band, and I got bored of being in a band, and then I had to get into doing scores, and what's this? It's this whole new world of music, and it's exciting, and it's a struggle, and I'm not used to it because I'm used to being in a band. So like this very much mirrors Jack Skellington is Danny Elfman.
What's this? What's this? It's a Sam Raimi film. I think he really is the unsung hero. And I know he suffered exhaustion like after doing this because it was such a grind for him. And he wasn't even one of the, what did they have? 120 stop motion people all working in tandem because it takes a week to do a single minute of this film.
Yeah, four sound stages going at a time.
I watched a show called Parks and Rec, and their character there, Ben, lost his job and decided he was going to do stop motion animation. And his wife came home and he said, like, I've been working on it all day. And I did a little stop motion animation. I tried to do a stop motion Star Wars fan film. I know exactly how long this kind of stuff takes.
Arnie, I don't know if you remember, but I don't know if it was for the 1 year anniversary of Star Wars Action News or you wanted to do a video podcast. I was doing little segments for the show then. You're like, anyone that contributes, you know, if you want to show your collection or whatever. And I did do some stop motion, Robot Chicken-esque humorous segments just done with, yeah, Star Wars toys. And it is grueling work. Like, and I had the help of Photoshop. Like, they didn't even have a whole lot of, you know, they had computers to move the cameras around the way they wanted. But I was able to just go into Photoshop and draw like open mouths and all that. I didn't have to have 200 different heads to pop on these things depending on the syllable I wanted them to say. It is grueling work. And what's funny is my girls last year, they really got into stop motion and it blew me away. Like the apps you could just put on your phone now that make it much simpler than it used to be.
Yeah, I do remember those stop motions. Those were awesome. And I admired them because I did it myself. So when the wife came home and Ben did it all day and he said he's worked all day, I said to Marjorie, I'm like, so he has 4 seconds. And then that turned out to be the punchline of the joke. So yeah, this is tough work, and I admire that they did it. I did wonder if they started like in 1987, but yeah, 4 sound stages.
Yeah, 4 sound stages, 3 years to do, over 200 puppets. It was crazy. Henry Selick basically got this job because he had experience and knew stop motion animators. And I guess when it's this kind of job, that's who you get. And really, the director for a stop motion picture, you want to do everything beforehand. You want to figure out the poses and the movement and the storyboard because it is so grueling. So he was there, you know, okay, have a move like this and do that because that was his expertise. And then you just kind of let it, the animators do their thing and then you watch it and go, yay or nay. But yeah, a whole lot of work going into this film, 3 years worth.
And what's funny is when it came out, a Disney executive was saying this budget was so much less than any Disney blockbuster, so it doesn't have to make Aladdin money to satisfy us, because all those people, all that time, it only cost $18 million to do.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that low. Yeah, it's made $75 million theatrically. That's with the re-releases. So again, not a huge. You think, you know, Incredibles 2, that's probably close to $1 billion at this point worldwide. But this came out at a different time when home video sales meant a lot. And once Disney got behind it, yeah, it took off. Again, a sleeper hit that had a slow build and has, now it's just kind of a staple.
All right, well, if it didn't make Aladdin money, it still must have a wonderful plot to have made something that we're talking about this many years later. So, Arnie, what is this?
Well, this is a fantasy tale of holidays like Easter, St. Patrick's Day, Valentine's Day, Halloween, and Christmas. They all came from towns inside trees in an ancient forest. Okay, so you follow me? There's a forest. In the forest are trees, and in the trees are towns.
Well, there's portals to towns. This is just standard multiverse stuff.
Okay, so they weren't like Keebler elves in the trees? Those were portals.
No, yeah, you'll see Jack fall into the tree and he goes through a vortex of some kind.
Well, when the movie starts, Halloween Town has just finished another successful Halloween of frightening people. But Halloween Town's Pumpkin King Jack Skellington, voiced by Chris Sarandon when doing the easy part of talking, but Danny Elfman when doing the hard part of singing.
I guess Prince Humperdinck can't sing.
Jack is bored with the same old grind. Wandering aimlessly, Jack's dog Zero leads him to the hub of the trees, and Jack discovers Christmas Town. Could you imagine this entire movie if it was A Nightmare Before St. Patrick's Day? What's this? What's this? It is a green beer. I'm drunk. I'm drunk.
I think that was our Leprechaun retrospective. That was a nightmare. To be continued.
But instead of that great film that I now want someone to make, he discovers Christmas Town and is taken by its winter wonderland. But when he returns to tell the people of Halloween Town, they don't get it. Except for Christmas Town's scary ruler, a large man named Sandy Claus. Jack decides he wants some Christmas, so he plots to have Sandy Claus kidnapped, and he'll take the fat man's place. The entire town is in on the plot, save for Sally, a rag doll voiced by Catherine O'Hara, who loves Jack from afar but is kept captive by her maker, Dr. Finkelstein, voiced by William Hickey.
Already recommend for you because of Hickey's involvement.
Hickey has done some crap, but...
I know you're a fan, though.
He's got a great voice in two Christmas classics, this and Christmas Vacation.
You've seen that one, haven't you, Jerry?
Oh, Christmas Vacation? Definitely recommend.
With Santa kidnapped, Jack starts delivering presents, but they scare the people of Christmastown, and Jack's sleigh is shot down by a missile. Meanwhile, Santa has been delivered to Halloween Town's meanest resident, Oogie Boogie Man, voiced by Ken Page, who actually seems to want to kill Santa and Jack and rule Halloween Town for himself. Jack, realizing Christmas needs Santa, returns to Halloween Town and fights Oogie. Pulling a thread on Oogie's costume causes the bag man to unravel, and Santa is able to restore a Merry Christmas to Christmas Town and to Halloween Town also, as it starts to snow and Santa delivers gifts to the Halloween Town residents. But the greatest gift for Jack is he's discovered love with Sally, and they stand together in front of the moon as credits roll. So that's the plot of the film, and as Jacob said, it's almost completely told by song.
I wrote down every time they started singing, and like within the first 15 minutes, there are three songs.
You talk about the difference between musical and opera, but I think of Phantom of the Opera, which is probably my favorite musical, and I had the double disc CD of that where they cut out the talking. I think it ran like 10 minutes shorter than the play. It really sang virtually everything, and that's what I think about this as well. But they start with a little bit of dialogue here, the origin of the holidays, and this is... Do they need to do this? Do they need to tell us this is long ago and where holidays came from? Does that help sell the story to you? Because it creates problems for me.
I can't wait to hear the problems you have with this child's fairy tale. But to me, it's just setting up later when Jack's going to find these doors. It's nice to know, like, what this is. Oh, okay, it's fairy tale land, holiday land, whatever you want to call it. And there's doors that go to each one. And that's where the Easter Bunny lives and Santa and scary monsters.
Yeah, if it wasn't for this, when he finds it later, you'd be like, okay, this is just out of nowhere. At least they take that. Here's the weird premise you need to know. Now let's just go and do something with it. And I think that's a fine setup. It doesn't take too long. It's not at least any more dumb than the whole thing is, but I like the setup.
I guess my problem was, first of all, I promise I won't do this the whole show because I
please don't.
I get more into the movie. But this is how the movie starts. And my immediate thought is, so the holidays live in the tree. Do they come out of the tree on the holidays? Where do the people who celebrate the holidays live? There's only 7 trees. What about all the other holidays? I counted Christmas, Thanksgiving, Easter, Valentine's Day, St. Patrick's Day, and Halloween. And then there was a red box with some stars.
That was a firecracker, 4th of July.
Are you sure?
I don't know, Guy Fawkes Day? I'm taking that these are American holidays.
Thanksgiving, come on.
Yeah, Thanksgiving's there. If your problem is that not all nations are represented here, fair enough, I guess. This is for white Christian Americans. This is their holidays.
This was 1993 before the international film market was a big priority.
Well, given that this takes place long ago, I think I just would have been happier without Thanksgiving and without 4th of July being so American-centric, and maybe include Hanukkah or...
Yeah, give us another one. Go ahead. I know there are some, but...
New Year's?
Yeah, New Year's, you could have the baby or something, sure. The Jewish people have their whole set of holidays. You can't just do Hanukkah. Then you got to throw in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, all of them.
Now, I realize I'm giving them a challenge now. Create the icon for Rosh Hashanah to put on a tree.
Look, Robot Chicken has already done this. They took a look at what the Nightmare Before Hanukkah would be like. And it might be culturally insensitive, but it wasn't as thrilling as Christmas.
But the people who celebrate the holiday live there. So the people of Christmastown have never had a Halloween.
Arnie, do you wonder why we believe Santa Claus lives in the North Pole? Like, why did we pick that place out of all places? It's a fairy tale.
Because we can't get there to verify it.
We can now.
We can now, but not when the lore was put in. Yeah, I mean, look, if you're going to look for, like, okay, how does this tree create Christmas for us in Ohio or us in Illinois or wherever to celebrate? That's not what this land is. So you're looking for your Marvel universe. How does this fit in with this universe? Just stop it. And Arnie, I'm with you because, I mean, remember, in 1994, I sat down and watched this movie for 5 minutes and decided I want to go play cards instead. This was the 5 minutes I had to sit through. So I'm with you. But 2018, I'm just like, okay, that's just the weird premise for a movie. You got to move on from that because it's not the point.
I agree. And we always say we give the film the mulligan. We'll give it the gimme it needs to have its plot. I'll give it here.
I mean, I could really dissect this film if you want this to be a 6-hour podcast. Like, how does Jack get the list for the good boys and girls? And how does he know where they are without the knowledge that Santa has? Like, yes, there are problematic plot devices throughout this film to move the story along if you want to get into the logic of Halloween Town.
So what we're saying is this is a movie about songs and feelings and forget logic.
Yes.
And stop motion visuals that are cool and unique. There's a look to this movie.
Especially in Halloween Town, you get your first song, This is Halloween, with all these monsters and ghouls. But I love the look of it. It just looks like it's all crosshatched or just lines everywhere, almost black and white. A great aesthetic for this film.
I really, during This is Halloween, got such a Beetlejuice vibe off of this. When you have, like, the snake hands and you see a snake that looks like the desert worms.
Yeah, I looked to see if Henry Selick worked on, as an animator or something, Beetlejuice. No, this is just all based off of Tim Burton's designs. That's why Jack has a black and white suit, just like Beetlejuice did. And yeah, those snakes look the same.
Yeah, I would not have been shocked if Beetlejuice was a resident of Halloween Town. Other than different studios, I guess maybe that would be a licensing issue. But I do love, and I will say the word love, the look of this. Maybe it's just playing on my Tim Burton nostalgia from Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands and, to a lesser degree, Batman and Pee-wee. But the look of this film during Halloween Town, as more of a horror guy than a Christmas movie guy, I'm really enjoying all the various varieties of monsters. Yes, you've got your staples, you've got your vampires, you've got your skeletons, you've got witches. But then you've just got these crazy looking monster type things that I understand why they make figurines from this movie and ornaments and all of that, because each of these would, you don't get the time to appreciate them as the camera zooms from one to the other. I feel bad for the poor sculptor who had to spend days and months making these things so they get a few seconds of screen time, but each of them really is a well-sculpted original wonder that yet still feels cut from the same cloth.
Yeah, I compare this to like Corpse Bride, James and the Giant's Peach, the feature length Frankenweenie. They just don't have this same vibe. There is, yeah, something more artistic, I think, here. It does feel like, because this was 3 years, and I'm sure those other films took a long time as well, but yeah, just the creature design here is great. Even when we get to Christmas Town and the way Santa Claus looks, he's even creepy looking. I just like the aesthetic in this film, and it fits the title, Nightmare Before Christmas.
The thing that I have to keep reminding myself is this isn't done by computer. Because it looks like it could just be stylized computer graphics. Everything is so good. There's a depth to the images because they had real sets and real people on the sets, but such a level of detail that I just keep telling myself somebody actually built this, and that blows my mind. I'd love to watch the making of this.
Yeah, built it, had to have trap doors so they could pop their heads out and move the characters just a little bit and then duck back down and take their picture. The only thing that was really computerized were the cameras. Again, they go, okay, here's the starting point, here's the end point, and this is how the camera, so they could program it so it could slowly move as they're taking these pictures. And that's why this feels, you know, a lot of stop motion could just feel almost like a stage play because you can't move that camera around. That's a whole other logistical nightmare to have a moving camera on a stop motion film. But this one, yeah, you're able, because it's a operatic musical, you're able to have some big sweeping shots because of that computerized camera and the mechanics that they were able to build in for that.
And there's also some classical animation here. I mean, they kind of Roger Rabbit it, right? I could tell that the ghosts, and when we see Oogie Boogie, just here, he shows up as a silhouette on the moon. I mean, that's obviously just classical cartoon.
Yeah, but then he turns into stop motion bats, which I think is great. Yeah, they do have some cell animation going on.
And too, I assume the dog, since he was in this ghost form, that he was some sort of computer or animated overlay or something. And I don't know, maybe if they did that as a way to dial it back of how much stop motion they had to do, or if they just Obi-Wan Kenobi'd it.
Again, there's no computer graphics in this, no CGI. But yeah, with Zero the dog, they had the head and that was real, and that'd be like floating around the set. But then the floating body, that was animated and overlaid, composited, all those different movie making tricks.
So yeah, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Right. He glows. No, he doesn't glow. He's see-through, or maybe he's not.
When you guys think of Halloween, does Halloween Town hit it? Does it hit all the big points for you? I was thinking about it. It's definitely horror light. Nothing here is really scary. Everything's cute, right? The vampires are cute. Nothing's ever going to scare a little kitty in this film.
Maybe a little kid, but yeah, they keep it pretty PG. There is one thing they do at the end when Santa comes and makes it all snowy. You see some vampires playing hockey with a pumpkin. Originally, they had Tim Burton's severed head, but they had to take that out and replace it with the pumpkin.
When I think of Halloween, I guess I do think of decorations. I think of trick-or-treating, and we have some trick-or-treaters here. But this does seem to be generic horror land. We're going to have all kinds of monsters and things. I mean, the boogeyman, yeah, we got Michael Myers as the boogeyman in the 70s film, but...
Do you want slashers? Do you want Leatherface to show up in this? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just saying the boogeyman is a year-round villain. I know kids were afraid of the boogeyman being under their bed in Midsummer. It didn't have to be a Halloween fear.
Yeah, but they're trying to put this into holiday boxes. So yeah, if it's scary, it's Halloween Town. Oogie's not going to be in 4th of July world.
And we're also introduced to our main character here, Jack Skellington, Pumpkin King of Halloween, Chris Sarandon. I never remember that. I don't hear Chris Sarandon from Fright Night or Princess Bride.
I always thought it was Danny Elfman doing everything for Jack.
Why wouldn't it be?
I don't know. I guess he's busy doing all the songs, so he couldn't show up to do the few lines that Jack has.
Or maybe he's not a good actor. I don't know. And line inflections and things like that. But I'll tell you what, when I first heard Jack start talking, I was like, oh, his voice is just kind of normal. I thought it would have just more of a creepy vibe to it. I know he's not the antagonist. I know he's not supposed to be scaring us the entire time. But I thought he would just have some Halloweenish character to his voice. Something that you're like, ooh, there's something a little creepy about that guy. Is he good or is he not? Because there are times throughout this movie, by the way, that I am wondering, like, hey, is Jack going off the deep end here? Is he going to become our antagonist? Or is he, well, I guess we'll wait and see.
Well, this is well after Chris Sarandon's heyday. You know, I thought maybe they did it because they wanted a marquee star. And I don't know that Chris Sarandon has ever been a marquee star.
William Hickey's bigger than Chris Sarandon, isn't he?
At this point, perhaps.
I mean, Catherine O'Hara is the biggest star as far as voice acting goes. That's the one name that sticks out the most to me.
Yeah. And when I saw Chris Sarandon at a HorrorCon, there was a Fright Night cast reunion and he had Nightmare Before Christmas photos he was signing. I'm just like, oh yeah, that is you. I mean, he's good, but I don't notice any tonal difference in the voice between when it's him and when it's Elfman singing. It's not a big jump. I mean, I guess you said they were doing The Grinch, and Boris Karloff did not sing the songs in The Grinch, but you could have fooled me. So maybe that's what they were going for?
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe that's how Chris Sarandon got cast, is because he sounded a lot like a talking Danny Elfman and then I guess could act a little bit. Maybe it's the other way around.
I bet you're right. You may be really onto something there, Jerry. But the style of Jack Skellington, I mean, despite only having seen this film twice, it's such an iconic design that I see everywhere. It's a very friendly design. I love him when he comes in as this flaming pumpkin, like Ichabod Crane, the Headless Horseman. And then he just like jumps in a bath and comes out and he's a skeleton.
Well, and Disney wanted to make him more kid-friendly. They wanted him to have eyes, and they're like, no, we gotta have him look like a skeleton. Like, Disney was afraid, thought even this was too scary for kids.
Yeah, because this is an era where Disney found their footing with the Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King was coming out soon, to where they got away from Ichabod Crane and Black Cauldron and...
Yeah, all the stuff I grew up on, which is maybe is why I'm liking this.
Which is, there's points in time in Disney's histories in the 70s and 80s when they weren't a successful film company, so I guess they wanted to make sure people weren't thinking that. But yeah, that would have been a horrible choice if they had kiddied that up and gave him eyes and more realistic features. It's goofy, but Arnie, you're dead on. I mean, everything about this design, yeah, even just the movie poster and all the scenes in there where he's in front of the moon, to me, I consider that iconic. I mean, you see that, you're like, yep, I know exactly what that is.
You guys are both parents. Do you feel this would be inappropriate under a certain age for your kids? Or do you think three-year-olds could watch this and enjoy the songs and the animation?
The last time I watched this was 2 years ago, showing it to my girls. The then six-year-old, well, back then she tended to get scared of a lot of stuff, and it was too scary for her. Now we showed her Shaun of the Dead this year for Halloween, and she's like, oh, this is one of my favorite films now that she's eight. So maybe for a real young crowd, if they're real timid, this might be a little too scary, but I don't think so. It's pretty tame.
Yeah, that's probably about right. I would think the 8, 9, 10, the songs kind of balance this out as being cutesy, and what's horrific, for lack of better words, is still over-the-top silly that it's like, yeah, the boy pulling the head out of the Christmas present, which was like the first.
Oh, my girls crack up every time that scene happens.
That's probably the creepiest looking thing they do, and it's still funny. So my kids are 14 and 17 now, so I wouldn't think twice about this. My daughter, she watched all the Harry Potter movies when she was 7, 8, so this is fine.
The songs, I was actually glad I had the sing-along version, because as Jacob said, so much of the story is told through the songs. I had trouble understanding all the lyrics at times. I mean, they're singing it so fast that I think, you know, if you listen to the CD again and again, I know from musicals I like, you learn the words, you figure out what they're saying. But a lot of this kind of went past me other than the choruses.
Use it as a subtitle?
Yeah, I wasn't singing along. I was just reading the lyrics.
I want that extra bonus footage. That should go to our patrons.
We got to see that video.
I don't think the lyrics, they're too hard to follow along. Again, this is Halloween, sets the setting, and then you get Jack. He goes into this remorseful song where he's up on the hill, and you get the idea, oh, he's not satisfied by just doing Halloween over and over. I don't have a problem following along with any of these songs.
I follow the spirit. Don't misunderstand me.
So it's like an Italian opera. You don't have to know the language. You can just feel the emotion of it.
Right, absolutely. But when you're coming in for Now Playing, and I'm trying to determine the character arcs of the guy with snakes for fingers, I needed a little bit more clarity into this. And then it turns out I didn't. But when Elfman gets going, and Oingo Boingo's the same way, they're lyrically fast, where there's so much nuance and every line hits. But it's going to take a few viewings to, I think, get all of them.
I mean, you're not totally wrong. When Jack gets to Christmas Town, you know, he's mournful, he's not satisfied with Halloween, he walks through the forest and he falls into that portal, and you get what's this? I mean, Elfman wanted that to sound like a tongue twister, someone just so excited they could barely get all the words out, and you definitely do get that vibe. Most of these songs I could probably sing along to, that one, you get some crazy rhymes going real fast in that one.
So Jacob, you just mentioned something. So Jack just wanders into this forest where all these holidays are at, so I mean, was there something unique that took him there, or is that just, I mean, I guess we see the three kids just go to it later.
Yeah, he says he just walked further into the forest than he's ever been. So I guess this has always been there, but it's just so far out of town, no one bothered going there. I mean, we'll see again later on, if you want to get into the logistics, how does this all work? We see Jack, he like dives into a mausoleum and he shows back up in Halloween Town. So there are different portals that they know about to get back to their world. My question is, how does he get back from Christmas Town to Halloween Town? Because it seems like he falls through a vortex. There ain't no forest in the North Pole, or they're under snow.
I was just wondering, was there something sort of divine that took him to it the first time? And then once he figured it out, obviously he sent the three kids to it, and Santa goes back and forth at the end. I mean,
I think he just happens upon it and then he knows where it is after that.
I thought that the dog led him, because he's kind of following his dog, and the dog, they're going to pull a Rudolph later on, but in these early scenes, the dog's nose is glowing. I felt like he was on some kind of radar or something.
His nose is a jack-o'-lantern. That's why it's glowing. If you look real close to it, it has a little face on it.
Oh, I did not catch that.
Nor did I.
No, I don't think Zero is leading him. I mean, Zero's just tagging along. We'll see Jack. It's funny. He takes one of his ribs out to play fetch with him.
I gotta say, my favorite two songs from this movie are right here at the beginning. I can't decide. Again, I've only seen it twice. But This Is Halloween or What's This are the ones that stick with me when the credits have rolled.
Yeah, like I said, on the radio, they would actually play What's This? That seems like the breakout one to me. But yeah, This Is Halloween's a great song too.
So Jack sees this. He's saying, what's this? So I guess he just isn't understanding. But is his goal to horrify the Christmas dimension? Or is his goal to find Christmas-like merriment and joy? Because it kind of goes the other way, and he doesn't seem to react to that.
Looking at this, trying to figure, what is the moral of this story? Maybe don't do cultural appropriation, which seems like a very 2018 moral, not one that would be out there in 1993. But yeah, trying to figure out what is the arc for Jack. And to me, once I heard Elfman talk about, oh, this is just me and the struggle I went through, I was getting bored with doing band music, and then I found scores and it's this whole new world. To me, it's just Jack is bored and he's just discovered all, what is this snow and these lights, and I've got this feeling in me and I want to share this feeling. We'll see him later on trying to do scientific experiments, trying to deconstruct what is Christmas and why does it fill me with this joy. But then the tragedy is, because it's Halloween Town and they just can't help but being scary, is that it all will go wrong.
And meanwhile, we've got in parallel the story of Sally. And I thought she was a Frankenstein, but when I was putting my notes together, I guess she's a ragdoll?
Yeah, she's kind of a combination of both. They had a lot of talks, like, what is she going to be filled with? Because they knew they were going to have her fall and her limbs come off. And they didn't want her to be scary because she's kind of the love interest and she's the kind-hearted one. She's the one trying to warn Jack not to go through with all of this. So yeah, she's like a scarecrow, a Frankenstein scarecrow. And this is a character, her and Oogie really seem like the new characters outside of that Tim Burton poem. Like, this is the stuff they put in there to pad out this story to try to get it to feature length.
Okay, so she was not part of the original poem. I've never heard the poem or read the poem.
You get Christopher Lee reading the poem as one of the bonus features. It's amazing.
That would be awesome, actually. Count Dooku reading the poem.
Or Dracula.
But in the era of Me Too, I really find her living situation a little grotesque, that William Hickey is a wheelchair-bound mad scientist who made her and wants to keep her locked up as his companion, as she has to poison him to get out at night.
And then she goes right back.
Yeah, she kind of gets caught and he has to go back. But yeah,
well, she has to get her arm. I mean, come on. I mean,
true.
I think I'd rather live as a one-armed person than allow myself to be subjected to endless rape by William Hickey in a wheelchair.
I don't know if that's going on. Again, very PG or even G-rated here. I never got that vibe. But yeah, this is an abusive relationship because he's the creator. He's Dr. Finkelstein, you know, not that far off from Dr. Frankenstein. He created her, so he feels like, yeah, that's his slave, and she's got to do whatever he wants. And she just wants to poison him, put him to sleep so she could get out. And I guess she's got a crush on Jack. back. That's the weird thing. This will turn into a love story by the end, but it's all just Sally's like in love with him, and Jack's just too into himself to even notice.
Well, they smooth that out at the end because when Finkelstein makes his second creation, or the second one we see, he says we can have more meaningful conversations. So there's certainly nothing. I thought that too. Is like, did he make a mate, or is he just make a servant because she cooks for him? Or
at the end, he's making a mate. He's very narcissistic. It looks just like him.
And he even put half his brain in it. I mean,
yes.
Yeah, but he even states, we're going to have good conversations now. He just wants somebody with a good personality.
He wants to talk to himself. He wants to be attracted to himself, I guess. But yeah, the Sally thing, I don't see how she influences his arc. She plays more like a Greek chorus, doesn't she? Because she's the only one going in the corner the whole time, like, this is bad, this is bad.
Yeah, she has like a vision, which is weird. I don't know why she's having visions, but she's doing that I love you not with that flower, and then it turns into a Christmas tree, and then it starts on fire. And so yeah, the whole rest of the film, she's trying to warn Jack, don't go through with this.
That was a vision? I was really confused by the flaming Christmas tree.
Well, where I've read people saying, or Wiki, whatever, that Sally can see in the future and has visions, and I assume it's only because of that one moment.
That's the only time she does it in this film.
I picked nothing else out in this movie that tells me that she would have powers, other than the fact that I guess she mixes a lot of chemicals together. Maybe she's just tripping, man.
She inhaled some of that frog's breath.
Man, I can taste colors and see flavors, man.
Yeah, she just doesn't have a key role in this movie the way I would like to see her integrated. Finkelstein does a bit more by having the job of making skeleton reindeer for Jack's evil sleigh.
The thing with Jack is that he is so into himself. Like, even at his lowest point, again, when he's doing those science experiments, he's like, I can't understand this. And then he's like, you know what? You just got to be confident, and I'm going to do this anyway. And we'll see that again at the end after he gets shot down. It's like, oh, poor me. But no, I'm great. I'm going to come back and do a great Halloween. Like, Jack is actually kind of full of himself. And yeah, I'd look at this after hearing Danny Elfman talk about it. Okay, this is the artist, and he's just consumed with his art. And here's this nice woman that wants to have a relationship. She's very grounded and down to earth. She's no Yoko. And he's just like totally doesn't even see her. He's busy making, yeah, smash trucks and creepy jack-in-the-boxes and all that to get ready for his Halloween.
But he thinks he's doing Christmas. He doesn't realize, because he's from Halloween Town, that it's going to scare people.
Well, no, he has that moment of clarity, I think, when he's got this town hall and he's telling everybody about Christmas and they're just not getting it. And so he's like, okay, let's give them what they want. And that's when he does his whole Sandy Claus, this lobster man.
Really, at the end of the day, Sally is us, because she's stating the things that we're kind of thinking is like, this is really weird that Mr. Halloween wants to go do Christmas. This isn't going to end well. So she's R2 and 3PO here. She's kind of our point of view. And it's got to be obvious really to anybody that what Jack's about to do and go take over Christmas, and not in a malicious way. I mean, like I said earlier, that's the one thing that I kind of wondered, is he actually trying to take it over? Like, I want this for myself? Or is he, after seeing it twice, I think he's completely sincere when he's like, hey, Santa, take the day off. I got this.
I agree with you, Jerry. I do think Jack is coming from a good place. It's just, he's like, I'm going to kick this old man, Santa Claus, out, and I'm just going to do it my way because I'm great. I'm the artist. I do these great Halloweens, and I'm sure I can do a great Christmas because it has just invigorated me.
I'm going with the vibe of this film. Let's just check the pulse of the room. Are you guys, I mean, Jacob, you're the fan, but Jerry, where are you with the film at this point? I mean, I am having these questions about the character and things, but yet it's not that kind of movie, you know? And so taking it as a Christmas special, it's a very short movie. It's under 80 minutes. Looking at it as a Grinch stole Christmas, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer type story, I'm going with it pretty well. I just wish it were more tightly integrated. I think having a musician as your main writer, I think it maybe could have used a bit more tightening up of the character arcs.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I'm giving this movie a lot of passes. Not because I think anything's poorly done, but it's just very unconventional. And that just fits the whole theme of the movie. Everything from its look to the songs to the plot. What if Christmas is more Halloween-like type of thing? It's just kind kind of weird. So there's some of these things that I give a pass to. And I very, very intentionally watch this movie twice, not because I just wanted to be familiar enough with it for a movie review like I normally would, but because I was like, okay, you know what? I didn't catch this. Is there something I missed about why he's doing this and why Sally's doing that? So I think there are definitely voids that aren't filled. But overall, it's not impacting my ability to understand it, because you hit the nail on the head. This isn't that kind of movie.
And moreover, it's a Tim Burton film, even though he's just a producer here and he wasn't on set that much. He wasn't making the puppets or doing the animation, any of that. But I like Tim Burton films. Well, up to a point, I like Tim Burton films. I don't know if I liked anything after Planet of the Apes, but Pee-wee and Edward Scissorhands and Beetlejuice. These are all films that I loved, but look, they're more set dressing than anything else. Like, they just have a weird, like you said, Jerry, unconventional vibe that appeals to me. And that's what appeals to me with this one. It's this really twisted take on Christmas, twisted for a kid's film. I'm sure there's more twisted versions out there for adults, but for a kid's film, I just like the naughtiness of it.
For me, not being a parent and not having interacted with kids since my nieces and nephews were very young, I don't consider any of this naughty. I view it as all as very, very safe, but it has the narrative quality of a make it up as you go along kind of story in my mind. I mean, yes, you have Sally there from the beginning, but as we've said, she even breaks out of her tower. Literally, she like plummets down and breaks bones, but because she's a rag doll, she can get up again and walk away. But she's not influencing the story. The other thing not really influencing the story is the bad guy, who we don't get to until the very end. We see him against the moon, Oogie Boogie, and he's going to then be brought up at about the halfway mark when three other characters, Lock, Shock, and Barrel,
Paul Reubens, Catherine O'Hare, and Danny Elfman.
Yeah, Paul Reubens, Pee-wee, post-scandal.
I think this is the only work he could get at that time.
He was also in Batman Returns, I think.
Yes, he was.
Tim Burton was just the only one hiring him.
He was in Buffy, too.
That's true, and he was great in that. He really was. But it just seems very flow of consciousness that Jack is going to get these three kids to go kidnap Santa Claus or Sandy Claus, and these three kids are actually disciples of Oogie Boogie and are gonna clue in this underground Cajun monster.
Yeah, this was always the weirdest thing to me, especially the first time I saw this. I'm like, why is he from New Orleans and why is he gambling? This seems very odd, this Oogie Boogie. They said they were just going for like a 1920s cartoon, something you'd see like in Betty Boop, some just over the top villain. But he does feel like, maybe it's because I've seen this so many times, there's a sense that he wants to take over Halloween Town. He wants to get rid of Jack. Jack, you know, there's a mayor, but Jack's really the one in charge. He's the one with the ideas. I love the mayor. He's got the two faces, just like any politician would.
I love the line, I'm an elected official. I can't make decisions.
Yeah. But Oogie wants to get rid of Jack so he could take over. I think Jack's the one keeping him under control. Could you expound it on that a bit more? Sure, because this is such a short film, you could have put in some extra scenes to make that a little bit more clear, I think.
Yeah, I found Oogie Boogie's role weird. I mean, you get it when it's obvious at the end, but like when, you know, you see the silhouettes and you see Jack just like, hey, whatever you do, leave Oogie Boogie out of this. I'm just like, what's going on here? Because they seem like they have like this mortal enemies type thing. And that's something I wish I would have had a little bit more. Especially because, you know, as we talked earlier with all the toys and the licensing and everything, you saw Oogie Boogie stuff all the time. I'm just like, oh, he has a cool song, but he kind of goes out like punk.
There is a different reveal that they had for Oogie. I'll talk about that at the end.
But yeah, we've got the three kids who are just teasing Oogie here. But does the movie need an Oogie Boogie? Because if you look at the Grinch as the story template here, who's the bad guy in the Grinch? The Grinch. And he's got the story arc, a tremendous story arc of redemption there. I really thought Jack Skellington was the villain of the story. He's the one orchestrating this hostile takeover of Christmas Town.
I mean, here's the problem when you take something meant for a child's book, and Tim Burton thought this would never get made, and he did shop it around, hey, can we just do it as a children's storybook like The Grinch, and think about how they had to pad that for that Jim Carrey film, or Cat in the Hat for that Mike Myers film to make those feature length. Oogie was not in that original poem, and I think it's weird because Santa Claus just shows up at the graveyard at the end of the poem, and is like, I'll take over and save the day now. This is more cinematic what they do than what that poem had. Is Jack, yeah, he's going to go in and save the day. It's a little bit more conventional, but I think they felt like you got to do something to get this over 60 minutes.
I guess then, Oogie Boogie, one scene at the beginning, and I know one scene is going to take them 8 weeks, but one scene at the beginning during the This Is Halloween, we had a great Halloween celebration song. One scene of Oogie Boogie being there like, I could do it better. That's all I need.
No, I agree. That's what I said, is they could have had just a little bit more that, like you said, would have taken 8 weeks, but just a little bit more to fill out what his motivations were. Again, maybe I get it because I've watched this so many times, but I remember the first time watching, I'm like, what is Oogie's deal? Like, why is he in this film?
I do like the kidnapping of Santa Claus. I find that to be just incredibly funny that the trick-or-treaters, and Santa has never heard of trick-or-treating, I thought it would go differently. I thought it would be like he was saying there weren't very many kids on the naughty list this year, but I thought Santa, being omnipotent, would know these three were on the naughty list. But no, they just throw a bag over him. And
okay, you wanted to get into logistics that bother me. The first time they capture who we think is Santa, they get the Easter Bunny. And that is, I believe, 35 days to Christmas. They don't get the real Santa Claus till Christmas Eve. It took them over a month to hunt down the real Santa Claus. They knew where those doors were. They knew to go into the one with the tree. Why did it take a month?
Well, they cut out all the scenes where they brought a leprechaun back, where they brought a turkey back, which I actually thought would have been a little bit funnier just because it's the holiday in between to have brought a turkey back. And then they'd be like, hey, we'll be seeing you soon, you know, like because he's going to get killed. I thought there had been some opportunities there. I don't know what mascot you would have brought back. I guess Uncle Sam. I mean, you could have had all kinds of things coming in an expanded edition.
I honestly thought they'd have brought back more wrong people, too. But yeah, they just time jumps. It's a convenience, you know? Like, they had to fill out all the days from Halloween to Christmas. I guess they should have spent more time with Jack doing those scientific experiments, maybe, because God only knows how many days, weeks he was up in that tower. He could have been up in that tower till past Thanksgiving and needed to hurry things along instead of, you're right, having a month pass where they only do two kidnappings.
Yeah, but they had to make all the toys. I do love that sequence, like smashing the toys. Or there is a vampire teddy bear, which is actually supposed to be a scary Mickey Mouse, they said on the commentary. They're like, because Disney was involved with this, we're able to get away with scary Mickey Mouse.
And yeah, don't use the rat, use the bat is better. I like the skeletal reindeer myself. I think that's that and the mouse with the little hat on. Those were my two favorite Christmas Halloween mashup things.
Where the movie really picks up for me is when the kids are interacting with these new presents. I think all that is hysterical. Along with, I don't know why this jumps out at me, but I loved it when he's slicing the teddy bear and all the fuzz just like, you know, pops out like he's disemboweling it. I mean, to me, all those visuals worked great.
Yeah, Jack like smashes the Christmas ornament and it glows green. He's like, but what does it mean? I'm wondering that too. Like, yes, you got some plastic to glow. What does that mean? I don't know what that says about Christmas.
The mathematical equation on the chalkboard is freaking awesome too.
I love it.
Yeah, I saw the square root of like the 25th and
yeah, times gingerbread men or whatever. I think this is, even again, this is Tim Burton's for marketing purposes, but it has his signature all over it. And I think that's where Tim Burton excels, is just great things to look at and it's fun to look at. And yeah, throughout this film, there's lots of little Easter eggs or just things in the background that are fun to watch.
But yeah, when he's delivering those presents, this is where it just screams Grinch, down to encountering a little kid who's gotten up in the night.
Not just Grinch, it's Rudolph too. Like before he takes off, Sally tries to stop this by creating fog. And yeah, Zero with his jack-o'-lantern nose is able to light the way and so they could take off.
I did wonder how they'd pull that off because I'm like, oh, they need Rudolph, but all their reindeer are skeletons. They don't have noses. I don't mind them cribbing. There's a fine line between theft and homage, but because they're doing it so blatantly, I feel it's homage.
Oh, yeah, I do feel like this is not like, look how clever we are. It's just like, hey, remember those Rankin-Bass Christmas specials you watched? Here's our take on it, and we're going to have a Rudolph show up. Again, in the poem, like, they set up that foreshadowing very early. They're like, hey, look at this Zero with this shiny nose like Rudolph. And then at the end, like, that pays off. Here, they didn't do that. He just shows up, and they're like, oh, you can light the way. But yeah, when you get into, I call it the real world. You know, you have these different holiday worlds, and then you have the real world where the holidays actually are celebrated. related.
That's what I was asking. I was asking about the trees at the very beginning. So there is a real world that the holidays go to?
Yeah, I thought that was obvious. This is where all the holidays are celebrated. So when they're celebrating the end of Halloween at the beginning of this film, it's because they were in the real world scaring people. And now it's Christmas and Santa Claus is supposed to show up and deliver all the presents to the children in the real world.
I'll be the tiebreaker here. That's not obvious.
Really? Okay. I thought it was obvious.
You know, he doesn't go to Christmas land the night after Halloween and just see the North Pole preparing a Christmas for people. Jack himself is in his Halloween land scaring the people of Halloween land. So no, that's not obvious at all. I didn't think...
Well, that's because it's Halloween land. Just everything's scary.
But that makes no sense then if there's a real world that other people do Halloween.
They don't go trick-or-treating in Halloween land.
Yes, they do. There's trick-or-treaters in Halloween land.
Lock, Shock, and Barrel do.
No, Lock, Shock, and Barrel go to the real world and scare people. That's how I took it. They're the ones pulling the tricks.
Yeah, but that's the way you took it. That's not obvious. This movie does not explain how these trees and portals, which to me is fine. I was imagining a world where these holidays just occurred in isolated lands.
That's what I was thinking too, and that's what I was trying to get at the beginning, is was this a long time ago because eventually some lumberjacks came down, cut off the trees, and then they all merged into a real world?
The places your mind goes during some movies. No, this is just where the holiday stuff lives. This is where Santa lives in his Christmas town, and I don't know, the Easter Bunny lives in his tree. And yeah, and then they come into the real world.
I'm with Jerry. This is not obvious because I thought Jack was in Christmas Town the whole time.
Oh, okay. I thought this was very obvious. Okay, but no, they have gone into the real world.
Explains why a military shows up, though, in a real world versus Christmas Town.
Yeah. I wanted to know why Christmas Town had missile launchers.
Call in the Christmas military.
Well, I started thinking of, like, the movie Toy Soldiers, and this is where, when I say it's like they're making it up as they go along, this is where, like, a five-year-old tells a story, right? Like, Santa Claus flies over the house, but then the military fires a nuke. It's, like, so random that they shoot him down with a missile.
Well, no, I do love that hilarious sequence where he's giving all these bad gifts. I love the wreath that, like, is choking the old lady with its tendrils that are growing out of it. And if that wreath ate someone, you just go through it. I don't think it'd do a whole lot of damage. It doesn't have, like, a digestive system. But
and my mind goes to weird places. Wreath digestive systems.
I probably don't want to Google that one.
But I do, because this is a kid's film, they're like, we gotta still believe Santa Claus is real. Spoiler, I guess, for any kids listening, maybe?
Kid patrons with credit cards.
Yeah. But yeah, the police are getting calls. What? An imposter Santa? We gotta get the military on. Again, this feels just very Tim Burton. Like, where do you go with imposter Santa? Oh, you bring out the military and start shooting shells at him to bring him down.
Well, I figure that's a capital offense in Christmas Town.
Could you imagine the real world if there is no Santa? There's no Christmas? I think that is an actual movie.
I think there's like 17 of those movies on Hallmark Channel right now.
But again, Jack, I just loved Jack's optimism. Like when those first start firing, he's like, oh, look, fireworks. They're celebrating the great work I'm doing.
Is that the moral here, or is it self-centeredness? Jack eventually realizes after being shot with a missile, hey, maybe this wasn't the right thing to do, but does this movie have a moral, and does this movie need a moral?
That's what I was saying earlier, is I don't really know if there's a moral to this story, because Jack, yeah, he's like, oh man, I ruined Christmas, but you know what? I'm the Pumpkin King, and I'm going to put on a great Halloween again next year. And then that's when he goes back to Halloween Town. He's going to save Santa to save Christmas. So he's got a good heart there. He wants to have a good Christmas because he realizes he ruined it. But he's like still full of hubris. Like, I'm going to be great again next year for Halloween because I've learned so much from this experience.
I just take the overall moral is be happy with who you are, what you're good at, what your skills are. Don't look at, oh man, I wish I could have that. I wish I could be like Santa. It's like, no. I'm the Pumpkin King, and man, next Halloween, I'm going to scare him. Like, it's just that self-acceptance. I think that's just the nugget on this, is that he just needs to be happy being who he is and not taking for granted, because he's like, oh, yeah, it was just like last year's Halloween and the year before that and the year before that. I mean, we all get in the ruts, and we all get when things get mundane for us, but like, man, be proud of who you are and do it.
Or at the very least, just learn to work with others. Like, hey, Santa, could I tag along with you and learn what this Christmas stuff's all about instead of trying to take over the entire holiday? But you do have to have that, yeah, Jack saves the day. He's going to come in and fight Oogie and save Santa and Sally. Again, Sally is like the moral center of this film. She goes and tries to save Santa and gets caught by Oogie and they're both tied up and they're going to get killed. But you get this little fight. It doesn't go on very long because it took months to animate. But yeah, Jack just pulls a string out of Oogie's burlap sack and he turns into a bunch of bugs that fall apart.
I like Oogie Boogie. Don't get me wrong. I wish he was better integrated in the story, but he might be my favorite character in this whole thing. I like the gambling Cajun soul singer. For some reason, I always like the bad guys in musicals. I always think they have the better songs. Like, I was thinking about it. I like Audrey 2's songs best in Little Shop of Horrors. If you look at Charlie Daniels' band, The Devil Went Down to Georgia, I think The Devil had better music.
Who's the bad guy in Grease 2?
All right, the Scorpions did not sing very well. They were not singers in Grease 2.
I didn't even know if that was a musical or not. I've never seen it.
It is a musical, and it's got some really rocking songs, like by the Four Tops, but it doesn't really have a bad guy.
Now, the original plan, if you looked at the storyboards, they never animated it this way. They just had a change of heart or whatever. But Oogie, it was going to be revealed. Those bugs were going to fall away, and underneath the bugs was Dr. Finkelstein. He was the one that was Oogie. He was trying to get rid of Jack to, I guess, take over or whatnot. And Igor helps him get away so he can make his counterpart that looks like him.
So if that was like a jealousy thing over Sally's heart was for Jack and not for him, not bad, but they never connected the dots on there, so I think the choice was probably better.
Yeah, no, it was all done in dialogue. It's like, Jack, you're so oblivious to Sally loving you. Like, they were just going to spell it all out. It was very clumsy.
It still makes more sense because it was a love triangle, and I thought the way Finkelstein ended up creating his own second creature to do better and just gave up on Sally was really convenient. So yeah, I kind of like that better. It at least gives some motivation for Oogie. But yeah, Santa comes out and saves the day as Santa is wont to do. I do love that Santa's not just immediately going to forgive and forget. He's going to give a little bit of a tongue lashing to Jack.
The original plan, you know who they wanted to get to voice Santa was?
Dennis Leary?
No, that's definitely a way to go. Because this is Tim Burton, he wanted to get Vincent Price to be the voice of Santa. I guess at the time, though, Vincent Price's wife had just passed away, and he just wasn't up for doing anything like that. So they went with a different voice actor. But I do like this kind of creepy, kind of mean Santa Claus in this film. I can understand, though. I mean, he has been kidnapped and almost killed. He could be ill-tempered.
Well, he was kind of downright gracious about it all, if you really think about it. Jack, just listen to Sally next time.
And this is when all of a sudden Jack realizes, hey, someone has the hots for me, and I'll go with that. It's not exactly a love story for the ages, but...
No, it's just kind of thrown in there at the end. And again, to give this film credit for its visuals, this was a thing. I don't know if it's still a thing, but like couples dressing up as Jack Skellington and Sally for Halloween. It's the weird goth kids, maybe. But that did become like, if you were an outsider group, like that was your couple that you would want to emulate. Relationship goals.
I've never seen that, and I've gone to my share of costume parties, but...
Again, it might have been something that passed. I remember it a lot more the years following this film.
Well, the story of Oogie Boogie did not end here.
Do those bugs get back together?
I guess so. What really happened is this movie made enough money in 2004, so just a couple years before that re-release, out for the PlayStation 2 came The Nightmare Before Christmas, Oogie's Revenge.
Have you played this? I've never even heard of this.
I have not played it. It was put out by Capcom. It got middling reviews. I did read it. The wiki has a nice plot summary, though. I mean, you just see how this is a plot. Is that Jack is given an award for most spines tingled by a non-corporeal being. And so as a prize, he's given the soul robber a green whip weapon. And he leaves Halloween Town. And after he leaves, Lock, Shock, and Barrel bring Oogie Boogie back to life by sewing him together. And he starts to take over Halloween Town. And of course, you're playing Jack and you've got a whip weapon and you got to fight minions and all of that.
Okay, sure.
Santa gets back into it because Oogie wants to kill Santa. You travel to Christmas Town as one of the levels. Burton did have input into that story. So he didn't want a sequel, though. Would you guys want to see this as an, not that story, obviously, but would you want to see A Nightmare After Christmas?
I'm not sure what that would be. Again, if the story is there, sure, but I feel like, yeah, this is a nice little package here. I don't need an expanded universe for this.
Yeah, I'm with Jacob. No, it's a one-off. I also don't need like a full CG reboot. Maybe that's what that Rise of the Guardians was trying to do with bringing them all together like that. But
oh, man, if you thought this mythology was complicated, go watch that one, Arnie.
I have it in 3D. If you search your local Big Lots, they have a ton of DreamWorks 3D movies for like $5 each. Load up. That's probably one of them. No, just keep this self-contained. That's the charm in it. Being that it's a, golly, what's that, 25-year-old movie now?
Yeah, we're celebrating its 25th anniversary.
Yeah, it's like, come on, let it go.
There is also a prequel game that came out in 05 for the Game Boy Advance. And no, I didn't play this one either. I don't even have a Game Boy Advance.
I know I got it on my RetroPie. Haven't played it. Didn't know it was on there, but I got all the Game Boy games.
But this one is the prequel that takes place a year before. And it helps set up Oogie, I guess, because he hears from Lock, Shock, and Barrel that Jack is scarier than him. And so they tried to kidnap Jack. But Sally gets involved and Jack helps townspeople and collects weapons and
there's gunfire. It got ugly.
You make that like 2 minutes of footage in this film just to round out Oogie and there you go. You got the character fully rounded. I don't know if you need a whole prequel for that.
I'm surprised there's not a kids book series or a comic series or something. But I mean, Burton allowed there to be video games, probably because there's a lot of money in that for him.
Is that Burton's call or Disney's?
It's Burton's.
Everything I read, I kind of was led to believe that it was Disney owns the rights to all this outright. And so if it's Disney, then yeah, heck, they're milking the crap out of it.
Well, they're obviously milking the crap out of the toys. And what I read was that, yes, because Burton did the poem when he was working for Disney, Disney owned the poem because it was considered a work for hire. But what I read was Burton convinced Disney to not do a sequel because he said Jack's visits Thanksgiving World would just be stupid. And he wanted to keep the purity of this. And maybe Disney will make a sequel. They seem to want to do direct-to-video sequels to virtually everything, even if they shouldn't. Like replacing Robin Williams with Homer Simpson in Aladdin sequels.
Give it another 20 years or 10 years and they'll do a live-action version of it like they do everything else. That would suck.
I'm just picturing like LeBron or some really lanky basketball player as Jack.
Oh, they're out there. Yeah, not LeBron, but there's like some 7'7" like players in other countries who you just don't understand how they're actually human or how they function. And yeah, they can pull it off.
But can they sing? Well, before they decide to reboot this into live action, let's see what you guys thought of this. Jerry, Jacob, do you recommend The Nightmare Before Christmas? Jerry.
You know, simply put, I do. I mean, even though it took me 2 tries to actually sit down and watch it, 24 years apart in time span between attempt number one and attempt number two, but I actually looked forward to saying, hey, I get an opportunity to sit down, watch it. The look of it's very unique. I think the stop motion is done very well, but also just like that. I love the callback to very early Christmas TV specials and how this connects into those. We've said a dozen times. Very obvious, very good without just trying to tell a conventional Christmas story. This is all like, take Rudolph, take Grinch, and do the opposite. I appreciate that. It's a short enough movie, so if nothing else, I mean, worst case scenario, I'd recommend it for folks to watch because it's not that much of an investment. I mean, 75 minutes, you get to take all this in. You're going to have some questions. We've stated here, there's a little bit of a void here, there's a little bit of void there, but overall, it doesn't take away from the experience. I think it's a good movie. I wouldn't call it a great movie, but it's good. And watching it in that, you know, this is kind of good. We're talking about it when we are around Thanksgiving because it's that in-betweener. Is it a Halloween movie? Is it a Christmas movie? Forget it. It's both. I mean, it makes sense. If you want to watch it Halloween, want to watch it on Christmas, want to watch it somewhere in between, hey, it works. So good marketing. It's a movie that covers 3 months worth of viewing opportunities. So definitely recommend if you're like me and you went the first 25 years of this movie's life without watching it, pop it in. You'll enjoy it.
Jacob.
Well, Jerry, you might say it's just good. I will say it's great. I do love this movie. And when I think of this, I think of concept album. You think of David Bowie's The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and The Spiders from Mars, or The Who's Tommy, or also The Who's Quadrophenia. Okay, Tommy and Quadrophenia, they made movies out of those, and yeah, they kind of gave it a narrative. But if you just listen to those concept albums, yeah, you kind of get a story, but it's mostly just a lot of great music, and that's what this movie really excels at. They got some great songs in here by Elfman, great, great artwork. The puppeteering, the animating, all of that stuff I think is fantastic. I'm a fan of stop motion, so just being able to watch it on this level is a lot of fun. And the aesthetic here, yeah, it's a Christmas movie, but it's also Halloween, so it's unconventional for both of them. You got skeletons running around with Santa, and you got demons making toys for kids for Christmas. So it's a fun movie for me. It's one you pop in, you have some fun, great songs, great animation, and yeah, is the story totally there? Are the character arcs totally there? No, they could have expanded on that, I guess. But I love the package, the way it got to us. So strong recommend for me.
Okay, then tell me what I'm missing, Jacob. Because when I see this, it's a recommend, but it's a mild recommend. I'll say that I like some of the songs. I really go with your concept album vibe, because I think this works better as a series of random music videos than it does put together as a narrative. What I was thinking of from the same year this came out, do you guys remember the band Green Jello, which had to change its name to Green Jelly after a lawsuit?
Absolutely, yeah.
And their Little Pig, Let Me In.
Oh, God, yeah, I do know that.
Claymation music video.
Yep, remember that as well.
Sadly, I do.
That's what I was thinking of here, is this is a much higher budget and much better production quality and honestly just better music than Green Jello. I had that album. It was really awful. But as music videos go, with music video logic, these are good. And there are three songs that I could see myself putting onto a Christmas playlist in rotation. And where I would revisit this would be hearing, strangely, This Is Halloween as a Christmas song, and What's This, and then Oogie Boogie song at the end. Those three are the songs I think I'd listen to again, whereas some of it just is, I'm not a musical guy, and so when you deal with songs like, very specifically, the one Sally sings, and the one about Jack being up in the tower doing his experiments, those are the ones that I'm like, yeah, they're functional, but I don't need those. But when it comes to a movie, it is missing so many elements that would invest me in the characters and invest me in the arc. And I know that they're trying to invest me in Jack Skellington with his existential crisis of, is this all I am? Is there nothing more than Halloween? But because he isn't connected to anyone, and he doesn't really have either friends or enemies until the very end, I can't say this movie moves me in any way.
I'll just say this, maybe because I originally saw this in my teens, where I was closer to my childhood years, because yes, this does work on cartoon logic, and I'm fine with that. That's why I'm like, well, it's obvious there's a real world that the holiday worlds go into, which was not obvious to you guys, but this is not a sophisticated adult story. This is one for children.
So, I mean, I love the visuals. I love some of the music. It's definitely a recommend, but there's a reason why I didn't revisit it after that first watching. It's funny because, you know, I use Letterboxd a lot. And after watching this, I went back to Letterboxd and logged it. And I'd logged it before. And I was like, yep, I feel the exact same way after the second viewing as I did the first. It's a fine movie. I'll give it a recommend, but I don't know that I'll revisit it.
Arnie, you and I are saying the same thing. This movie was fine. I'm glad I watched it. I may even show it because my daughter said she would watch it again. My son's never seen it. My wife's never seen it. So I would sit down and watch it again. I mean, Disney sent me the Blu-ray. I got to get another viewing out of it. And by sent, I mean I paid for it.
And not a penny.
Yeah, but I just didn't necessarily agree to pay for it, but I didn't not agree to not pay for it.
Let us know about Hocus Pocus as well, then.
Yeah, absolutely. If that's your rule, is you must watch it multiple times because you paid for it. Let me know how that Kathy Najimy Bette Midler goes.
You know, it was a single purchase for a relatively low amount of money. So if I get like 4 or 5 viewings out of this movie, I don't need to touch that one.
So Hocus Pocus is just the bonus disc.
Exactly.
You don't have to watch the extras. You just watch the feature.
I haven't seen it, but I somehow believe I will recommend The Nightmare Before Christmas more than Hocus Pocus, but...
I totally get why this became a cult hit. Now it's kind of mainstream. I mean, the visuals, the music, all of that. It's Tim Burton. It's unique. It's when Tim Burton was doing better stuff than he has been doing the last two decades now. But yeah, I totally understand why this became a sleeper hit and why there's toys and shirts and people dress up like this and why they do the Haunted Mansion this way for almost 3 months every year.
Yeah, I do get it. And I think it works better as merchandise than as a movie. I really do.
That's very Disney of you.
Well, it's because the visuals are so striking. You can hang these things in your house around Halloween, and it's perfect.
And you can sing the songs, but I just can't see getting invested in the characters. But I'm glad, Jacob, that you are a big fan of this, because I wanted to see that insight. I wanted to see inside the mind of a fan of this, because I feel like maybe I'm just a couple years too late. You're slightly younger than me.
I agree. That's what I said. I think because you didn't see this when it first came out, there is a window. And again, for me, I just really dig this animation style and how everything looks. I just appreciate it on an artistic level as well. I think there's enough story here for it to get by on artistic merits.
Well, I appreciate, again, I'll just say, our patrons. Thank you for joining us for this holiday show and joining us the whole year round. Just to give you some insight into what is coming up for you patrons on this special feed in the new year.
More Disney?
Not immediately. Next month, we're finishing up our M. Night Shyamalan retrospective series and reviewing the second two parts of his East Rail trilogy with Split and Glass. And while we're talking about realistic superhero movies, patrons are going to get to hear a review of James Gunn's movie Super.
Oh, are we allowed to do that anymore?
We are, because we are not beholden to Disney. And then we will be caught up. We will have reviewed everything James Gunn has done.
Yeah, you got to get the book for Slither.
And Jerry, Jacob, thank you for joining me. And until next time, now playing We're Here in a Flash and Gone Without a Trace.
There's only 365 days left till next Halloween!
364!
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Nice work, Bone Daddy.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
We'll have conversations worth having.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
I have every confidence in you.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
No, now that's all wrong. This thing will never make a present.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
Haven't you heard of peace on earth and goodwill toward men?
No!
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved. Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2018, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
It's over!
We did it!
Wasn't it terrifying?
What a night!
Great Halloween, everybody!
I believe it was our most horrible yet!
I've never seen Hocus Pocus.
Yeah, I'd be the newbie on that one, too.
We'll all be the newbie.
No, seriously, how is that a major thing with people today? How is that?
Hocus Pocus has a big cult following. I don't get it because I've never seen it. Panic at the Disco. I've heard the name. Don't know any of their music.
All right, I know them because they did the Snakes on a Plane thing, but then I really liked the band, and now I have all their albums. But I couldn't stand Jim Carrey's Grinch.
Ugh.
Could anybody?
Nope.
I don't know. It made a lot of money when it came out. It convinced them to put Mike Myers in a cat suit.
Was that Mike Myers? I thought that was Jim Carrey.
No, it Cat in the Hat was Mike Myers.
Cat in the Hat, the follow-up.
Yeah, the follow-up, because okay. Grinch was so successful.
Yeah, I'm like, that was Mike Myers the whole time?
Man, Mike Myers does the best Jim Carrey.
But Mike Myers can't do anything but Mike Myers. I swear to God, he was doing Fat Bastard in Bohemian Rhapsody.
I didn't know he was in
that.
Oh,
I didn't know he was in it.
He is, but he's trying to do an English accent. It's Fat Bastard. It is just Fat Bastard.
No, it's Austin Powers.
What's this? What's this? It's a stop motion film. I've been doing this ever since I watched the film, by the way. It's driving Marjorie bats.
Well, don't have children because that's kind of what they do. What's that? What's that? What's this? What's that?